This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a look at the future of self-driving cars. But first, if you're a listener to this show, when you listen long enough, you know that one of our favorite topics is the microbiome. Our gut bacteria, our microbes, trillions of them have been linked to everything from mental health to obesity to drug efficacy. This week, researchers report that they dug up samples of an ancient microbiome that can offer insights into human migration. My next guest is here to tell us about that story and other selected short subjects in science. Azin Gureishi is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the microbiome. What's going on here?
So you have to first introduce Otzi. Otzi is a 5,300-year-old frozen iceman that was found in the Southern Alps in 1991. He's been studied a lot. So people have studied his clothing, his tools, his tattoos. He's the oldest tattooed man that we've dug up so far. And now they're starting to look at his microbiome. So scientists sequenced the DNA of his entire stomach, and they found a type of bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. That's currently found in roughly half of our guts today. And in about 10% of people, it causes things like gastritis, ulcers.
Right.
It can lead to cancer. But for the most part, we sort of happily coexist. So what's really cool about this is that not only do we now know that H. pylori has been part of our bacterial cargo for a really long time, we also can sort of use the evolution of the bacteria to sort of trace human migrations. So the scientists looked at his particular strain and saw that it was similar to the Central and South Asian strains, different from sort of the modern day European strains that we'd see. So that sort of suggested that predecessors of early European farmers had interacted with Asians before migrating to Europe, and then later sort of African strains had entered, producing the modern-day strains we see today. Wow. And then another really cool thing I thought was they showed that he sort of had the immune response we see in humans for H. pylori being there for a long time. So it was possible that he suffered from ulcers. Poor Otzi.
Poor guy.
Yeah.
Poor guy. Let's move on to a study of in the Netherlands that looked at the HIV prevention treatment PrEP.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people have heard about that.
Yeah. So it's actually a huge deal. It's a recently developed once-a-day pill that, when taken properly, can prevent the transmission of HIV. So it's basically, it's pre-exposure prophylaxis is what it's actually called. It's basically two meds that are used to treat HIV so that if someone is exposed to the virus, it basically can't take hold in their bodies. And public health officials have been recommending that more and more people sort of take it as a preventative measure in the U.S., but it hasn't really sort of entered the mainstream in Europe. It hasn't passed the sort of regulatory bodies. It isn't publicly available, so you kind of have to arrange with your doctors. So this study was done using data from 617 HIV-positive men in the Netherlands, where they sort of keep and anonymize all the health data of all their citizens and then give it to scientists to research. So this is all of the people who have been diagnosed as HIV-positive from 1996 to 2010. And from that, they could sort of tell who contracted HIV from who by tracing sort of the evolution of the virus.
Mm-hmm.
And what they showed was they did some clever modeling that if half of those men had been tested annually for HIV and the positive ones had been put on treatment and the other half had been put on PrEP, roughly 66% of the infections could have been prevented. So this was basically making a strong case for why PrEP should be part of the sort of gamut of things that we're doing to sort of tackle HIV.
Brain training games have become very popular and are marketed as a way to keep your memory up. And one of those companies, Lumosity, which you've probably heard them advertising a lot, including sometimes on this program, is being sued by the FTC. Tell us.
Yeah. So brain games, like you said, are really popular. They've become popular in sort of the last five years or so. And they claim to help people perform better at work, better at school. It also, they sort of claim to stave off memory loss. And it's a huge market. It's valued at around $1.3 billion. And on Tuesday, the Federal Trade Commission ordered one of these companies, which makes Lumosity, to pay $2 million to settle charges that their claims are unfounded, because one of the big things is that they say that they're backed by science. The FTC said that they, quote, preyed on consumer fears about age-related cognitive decline. Sort of, they do market a lot to baby boomers, particularly stressed about dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that. So this is huge. They basically said that their science was unfounded and that they now have to pay back the money for the people who have bought their product, and also let the other people know that this happened.
You know, FTC going after food producers and is not something. It's not something new. It's happened before, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I'm trying to remember where one of the big pomegranate juice makers a few years ago was forced to take back some of the claims they had about longevity and implying it was, you know, it was almost medicine, things
right.
like that.
Yeah, and I mean, they say they're backed by science, but, you know, a lot of the studies are done by the companies that make the products, and a lot of the studies aren't actually publicly available for people to verify, so it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, a lot of medicine works that way also.
Yeah.
Finally, our researchers found a possible connection between sleep apnea and heart health.
Right.
If you're not sleeping. But the apnea is a certain kind of not sleeping. It's not just insomnia, right?
Right, right. So, yeah, sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, is a disorder which causes, among other things, snoring. And it can actually increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. And this has been known for a while, but scientists didn't really know why that link existed. So basically, during sleep, the muscles in your airway relax. If the relaxed muscles block the airway, that can deprive you of airflow and cause you to snore. Can be kind of dangerous. So this Columbia group looked at cells that line blood vessels where cardiovascular damage tends to start in people with sleep apnea and without it. And they saw that in the people with sleep apnea, they're more vulnerable to attacks from the immune system, their cells. They're more likely to be damaged, and then they therefore obstruct blood flow. So that is sort of the link to the cardiovascular disease. And interestingly, they showed that in the few people in their study that had sleep apnea but were also taking cholesterol meds, statins, those people actually had healthy cells.
Oh,
so something news. About that link, I mean, it needs to be investigated further, but it's definitely something curious to look into.
Yeah, it's always sleep is something that seems to be, you know, linked to so many things.
Yeah.
So many health things. Thank you, Azeem, for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Azeem Gureishi is a science reporter for BuzzFeed News here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Well, last Friday, maybe you were one of them, the Polar Bear Swim Club members across the country rang in 2016 with a shiver-inducing ritual, that is, an icy dunk in a local waterway. And here in New York, the speedoed and bikinied members of the Coney Island Polar Bear Club met for the 113th New Year's swim. And this year they got off easy because the water was only 50 degrees. It was warmer than usual. But we wondered, is there a side benefit to all of that chill? Could cold help these human polar bears, so to speak, and us shed a few pounds? Here to weigh in is Megan Thielking. She's head writer for Stats Morning Rounds. She joins us today from chilly Boston. Good day to lose weight in Boston today, Megan.
You know, it's a little chilly outside, so probably so.
Let's talk about it. So is cold a good thing if you're looking to shed some pounds?
So, good news is cold does help you burn fat. And if you think about it, it makes sense because your body is always trying to keep that even 98.6 degrees. So, being cold means your body has to work harder to keep that normal temperature. But it kind of depends on what kind of fat we're talking about burning. And research in the last 10 years has clarified exactly what fat we're burning when we're shivering. And it comes down to these two basic kinds of fat called white fat and brown fat. And brown fat is the fat that's deeper inside your body. And it's what your body burns to burn calories, if you think about it. White fat's the kind of fat that you can kind of pinch on your skin. And in research, it's shown that brown fat is actually a promising target for therapies to lose weight, and particularly to fight obesity. So a study actually last month came out showing that in mice, if you expose mice to cold repeatedly for a span of about 10 days, the cold actually changed the microbes in their gut and helped them lose weight over that 10-day span and then a few weeks after that. So it seems like a promising avenue for research that cold changes the bacteria in your gut. It's making a difference in your digestion. But, so, you know, the good side is it could be possible that shivering outside is, helping you burn a little more fat.
Of course, there's got to be something bad about this, too. I mean,
yes. So
how do you get
not...
cold all the time?
yeah. Don't embrace winter too much. Because it's not really clear that cold is going to help you burn all over fat. And it varies a lot from person to person how much shivering is really going to help you lose fat. And pretty much all of the options we have out there right now, like I said, it's a promising avenue for research, but all of the options we have out there right now are pretty scientifically questionable. So there's one that's actually performed in doctor's offices. It's this procedure called cryolipolysis, and it's like a device that looks like a little electric face exfoliator maybe, and it's held to a certain place on your body where you want to lose fat. And basically what it does is freeze your fat cells to death. They actually die. It's not about changing your gut microbes. It actually just kills off those cells. But it's a slow process. It can take a few hours, and you can only use it one spat at a time. And then it actually takes like weeks to months for that fat to be excreted from your body. So it's just a very slow process, and it only works on one spot.
So I can't just take some ice cubes and throw it on my stomach and expect it to
interestingly,
work.
There are some DIY approaches to doing that, but there's very little science behind them. There's this whole market that I find very interesting for ice pack fests, which basically are what you're saying. You strap some ice cubes to your body, but the science is pretty shaky out there. They've really just been small trials run by the companies themselves. But the idea is that it helps you burn all over fat because you're just shivering while you sit there.
Yeah, well, I'm
going to... But to me, that sounds very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I would rather sip ice water all day. Now, I've never had any nutritionist say that works, but I, going to keep doing it anyhow. Megan,
I mean, it makes sense.
It does.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Megan Thiel King is the lead writer for Morning Rounds at Stat in Boston. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and look at the future of self-driving cars. All the rage this week in Las Vegas, and not at a car show. It was an electronic show. We're going to see how it may shape your driving and how it may shape public transit. So give us a call if you want to participate. Our number 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you look around the exhibit floor at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this week, you might have thought that you took a wrong turn and ended up at the Detroit Auto Show. Transportation systems were big, from tiny electric scooters to plans for entire fleets of autonomous cars. Chris Ziegler is deputy editor of The Verge, and he's been at the CES show all week. Welcome to the program. Boy, you must be tired, Chris.
Oh, you're not kidding. It's been a week, and then, like you said, we go right into Detroit. So
that's right, the next week after. So tell us about the big trends you're seeing. The autonomous cars are making big splash, so to speak?
Autonomous cars are big here, as they have been basically every CES for the past 3 or 4 years. This is sort of seen as the place to show the tech side of the auto industry, whereas Detroit and New York and L.A., some of those other big car shows, are really more focused on the design and, horsepower, a very classic car news opportunity. But here it's really about the tech.
Yeah, and what about electric cars? Have they taken a backseat, or are we seeing more of them being shown?
Electric is big here, too. Electrification, connected car, autonomous, those are the big three. And with electrification specifically, of course, GM probably made the biggest news here with the introduction of the Bolt, which is their production, high-range, relatively affordable EV that's going to be hitting the market later this year. And Volkswagen is trying to make good on its diesel problems with the Buddy. It's called BUDD-E, which is a throwback to the classic microbus, but with an electric drivetrain.
Mm-hmm. Cars are the next big space for the Internet of Things, right? Tethering all of our devices together. Are you seeing where cars are going to be interconnected, talking to each other on the roads?
Yeah, so there's a technology called vehicle-to-vehicle, V2V for short, that will be debuting on production cars this year, where cars on the road can sort of make an ad hoc mesh network and talk to each other and let each other know when, say, one car is braking really hard, but you can't see it. that notification can come into your car so that you're more prepared to brake hard if there's an emergency ahead of you, for instance. But then going back to the Internet of Things more generally, there were a couple interesting announcements here. Ford is playing around with working on the Amazon Echo. So, for instance, when you're sitting in your house, you can say, Alexa, what's the battery level in my car? And then your Echo, the little voice box in your house, will tell you whether your car is charged or not.
Well, you have to have a car that's charging in the driveway, a garage or something.
That's right. That's right.
Like that. Has there been any talk about the GM-Lyft partnership was announced?
Yeah, that's been a surprisingly low-key announcement. I thought that was going to make a big splash here and people were going to be talking about it a lot. But I think that cynically it's seen as a very defensive maneuver that doesn't necessarily have any short-term technology implications, because Lyft doesn't bring a lot of self-driving experience to the table, not as much as Uber, which has its own self-driving R&D lab in Pittsburgh. In the very short term, this might be more of an opportunity for GM to just sell vehicles into Lyft's fleet. But we'll see. We'll see if it actually turns into something bigger long term. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we hear autonomous cars, they've been a feature of the CES for a couple of years now. But are we seeing something radical that is going to actually move the dial a bit?
No, and that's my concern. The term that I've been using here is that we're in a hype gap. Where there is a protracted phase of hype around autonomous cars and not a lot of substance, not a lot of things that people can really sink their teeth into. They can't take a self-driving car out on the road. But it's trickling out. We have things like Tesla's Autopilot, which is now in beta in cars that are on the road. GM will be debuting something this year called Super Cruise, which is a similar feature where when you're on the highway, you can press a button and let the car drive itself. But in terms of announcements here, they've been pretty low-key. Ford announced that they're using a new higher-resolution sensor, for instance, in their research self-driving car. So very incremental stuff. And then I think toward 2020 is when we're going to see this huge moment of a bunch of automakers releasing a bunch of at least partially autonomous vehicles onto the road.
Yeah, well, we'll be talking about it a little bit more, but I want to wish you stay healthy. Walk those floors. Good luck. Good luck at the Detroit show next week, right?
Thank you very much. Yes, it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, we'll see more of that stuff there. Chris Ziegler is the deputy editor of The Verge, and he has been at the CES show all week. But if self-driving cars do become a widespread thing, think about that. How is that going to change the way you get around, or the shape of our cities, or our public transportation? Joining me now are two people who think a lot about transportation and how it fits into the fabric of our lives. David King is an assistant professor of urban planning at Columbia University here in New York. He's here in our New York studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Handy is director of the National Center for Sustainable Transportation. That's at the University of California at Davis, as they say, UC Davis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Delighted to be here.
All this talk about autonomous driving cars, David, how easy is it to imagine where all of this is going? Or are we just pie in the sky at this point?
Right now, I think it's mostly pie in the sky. We're very good at predicting the direction of technology, and we can be very confident that we're going to have self-driving cars in the not-too-distant future. We're very bad at predicting how people are going to use them. And ultimately, until we know how much they cost, how much a trip costs, how we price our roads, how we adjust our parking and so on, we're really not going to have a good idea as far as how autonomous cars affect our cities.
But so now would be a good time to think of the macro picture.
Exactly. Now's right? A good time to think of the macro picture. And it's not that doesn't mean that we have to regulate these cars, but we need to think about what's the role of our streets. What do we want from our streets? One of the things that we're trying to do now in cities is we're trying to slow down traffic, and we're trying to create streets where people can play and they can walk and they can bike, they can be comfortable. Those are not necessarily streets that we're going to want any robot car to decide is a good street to drive down. And that's one of the issues that's happening. We've seen this with Waze in Southern California. Waze is a traffic routing
app. Yeah, I use that
app
all the time. Yeah.
And they will route people off of the freeway through residential neighborhoods. And these residential neighborhoods have quiet streets, and they expect quiet streets. But the algorithm doesn't care. A road is a road is a road. And so there's a lot that we have to rethink as far as how we classify our streets and mostly how we charge for access to our streets.
Mm-hmm. Susan Handy, is the autonomous car going to replace our cars, or is it just going to be a separate additional mode of transport?
Well, I think as David said, it's really hard to predict exactly how this is going to play out in terms of how people will respond. I think it's probably a mistake to think that this is going to revolutionize everything. Likely, we're going to see some evolution over time as to how autonomous vehicles fit into our transportation systems. And it could go some very different sorts of ways. It could end up being kind of an individual ownership model where every household has its own autonomous vehicle, or it could be much more of a shared model where we have privately or publicly owned fleets of autonomous vehicles that give individual rides or even shared rides. Mm-hmm. And how it evolves has huge implications for our cities and for the environment.
Especially since, you know, people choose where they live by a sort of a commuting distance to a central hub. If you have an autonomous car that sort of mimics a train, because you get in, you can do your homework, you can, won't that create more suburban sprawl, Susan, moving outwards from where you are normally spending your day?
Yeah, well, again, I think we need to be careful thinking that this necessarily leads to one kind of future or another, but it certainly does make it easier for people to live farther from where they are working. And so to the degree that there are people out there who would like to do that, then autonomous vehicles could help to facilitate that. On the other hand, you know, we are seeing evidence that there's an increased interest in living in denser urban environments, the kind of streets that David was talking about. And in that case, autonomous vehicles may play a very different role in the lives of people living in those kinds of environments.
David, let's go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, again, until we know how we charge for these, if you're paying by the mile or paying by the minute, you're still not going to live way out in the exurbs and then use this to commute into the city center. And regardless of how the technology works out, an hour spent in a car is going to be less enjoyable than an hour spent at home or at the movies or out to dinner or something like that. So we're going to see people change their behaviors based on how the technology evolves.
But your car that's in New York, for example, and you know what traffic in New York is like, the pedestrians in New York play chicken with the traffic, right? They do not pay attention to the rules. They have terrific jaywalkers. Can you design a car that's not going to play chicken with the pedestrians, or the car will never move, right?
Well,
if it always sees pedestrians crossing the street.
So I think it's plausible, maybe not probable, but it's plausible that autonomous cars will require even more road rules to our roads, that pedestrians and cyclists and trucks and all these other modes are going to have to be very constrained in their movements so that the robot cars and the robot trucks and everything else are able to move freely. That's one possible scenario. The technology is such and developing so quickly, I don't think we can say with any certainty how that will work out.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was thinking of, there's a traffic cop, right? Does the car know that there's a traffic cop directing traffic and the lights are not working anymore? I would imagine you would have little transmitters. We were just talking here, heard about the car show, where the cars are talking to each other. Not only would the cars be talking to each other, but it might be talking to a FedEx truck that's sitting there, knowing that it's figuring out there's a chip in that, telling it it's sitting there.
Yeah, these are all plausible scenarios. And right now, there's sort of an idea that there's going to be a benevolent supplier of the cars, and then there's going to be all these other technologies that go on, and we really don't have any idea how they're going to work together. But it's very much the case that the future of our roads is in flux right now.
Susan, there are a lot of old versions of the future. You know, you go to these future works or world's fairs and things, and they have streams of identical car pods moving along, sort of attached to one another, like a train. Does that seem likely?
I think the possibility that autonomous vehicles could turn into a public transit system like we've seen in some of those older visions is pretty interesting to think about. Whether it's going to happen that way or not depends on a lot of decisions we make about how we regulate mm-hmm. them and what sort of public investments we make in this innovation. Whether it's likely, I don't know.
Our number 844-724-8255. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow. Let's go to the phones to Bill in Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hey, this autonomous vehicle discussion over the past couple of years seems to completely ignore the opinions or interests of people like myself who are automotive enthusiasts, people who love cars, work on cars, restore classic cars, want to drive them and experience the driving process. And what's particularly frightening is driverless cars reach some sort of critical mass, they're obviously going to have some effect on the roadway system. And it may be such that people like me can't go out for a Sunday drive and enjoy the process of driving because the roads are designed more like almost like railroad tracks than open highway.
Mm. Good point. David?
Well, it was a few years ago that James May of the Top Gear show said in the future everybody's going to drive Ferraris. And what he meant by that was when autonomous cars come around, the only people who drive are going to be the enthusiasts like yourself. And they're going to drive cars that are really fun to drive. And that becomes an issue. And again, how that works out in the future depends on how we regulate our roads and our streets and how we pay for them. That if these are a source of commerce and if there's businesses that depend on having our traffic flow mm-hmm. freely, then it might not be that you're able to drive in cities doing that. But in rural areas, I suspect there'll always be open roads.
Susan, what factors go into people's transportation choices? How personal are these decisions?
Well, one theory of travel behavior says that people maximize their utility, that people choose the option that makes the most sense to them. And, of course, that's going to differ for everyone. So some people put most weight on the monetary cost or the travel time. But we know that there's also this element of enjoyment. So that's going to factor in as well. And different people are going to make different choices mm-hmm. depending on what their own needs and constraints and preferences are. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that's partly why it's so hard to predict how this is all going to play out.
Yeah. You know, we have a whole generation of kids, and I mean people, kids 5, 10 years old, who have grown up in the back seat of a car just playing video games or working on their cell phones or something like that, who don't seem to care at all about the drive. Whereas when we were kids, we wanted to be in that front seat doing the drive. Is this going to help just move that whole population to self-driving cars? Because, look, I'll be able to do what I did as a kid, and I don't have to change my habits.
I think a big issue there is, do they want to drive, or do they just want the access and the mobility? And if they just want the access and the mobility, we can continue to offer that through self-driving cars of some sort, and they don't ever have to learn to drive. And that would be wonderful in terms of safety on the roads, that mm-hmm. if we can have robots driving our cars, our roads will be safer. And I think that's a real issue, that kids probably want to maintain that mobility and that access, and they may not care about the actual physical act of driving, but we've been making driving easier over the decades through cruise control and automatic transmissions and self-parking now and all these other things anyway.
But, you know, it's going to take a while no matter what happens. I had a discussion with the executive at Toyota a few months ago, and I said, you know, the biggest selling car in America is the Ford F-150 truck. I don't think those people are going for autonomous driving anytime soon.
Well, to relate this to a question that you asked Susan earlier, there's going to be a lot of market segmentation in this, that a pickup truck is not going to be easily replaced by mm-hmm. an autonomous taxi. And there's just no way that that's going to happen. And you're still going to need these many different types of vehicles.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk lots more about self-driving cars. And we're going to expand the discussion to talk about who's legally responsible in a fender bender between two self-driving cars. can you sue the computer? And that's something that I'm sure the insurance companies are thinking all about that now. Stay with us. Our number 844-724-8255. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about autonomous vehicles, the coming age of self-driving cars. My guests are David King of Columbia University and Susan Handy of UC Davis. And when it comes to self-driving cars, one of the big unknowns centers around the law and liability. So when a car that's driving itself gets into an accident, who's at fault? If two autonomous vehicles get into a fender bender, who pays? The computer driving the car? Your insurance company? Brian Walker Smith is an assistant professor in the School of Law at the University of South Carolina and an affiliate scholar in the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. He's based in Columbia, South Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So the big question on most people's minds is probably one of liability. Who's liable? We have not figured this out yet.
And it puzzles me sometimes why that is one of the most interesting questions, because we know who suffers when there's a crash. It's the person who's injured. And then the question is, who ultimately bears the costs for those injuries? And it's everybody. We do through the purchase price of the self-driving cars or the driverless car ride we might take, or the purchase price of the package that might be delivered by a driverless vehicle, or the price we pay for our insurance or our medical care. So in between, the question of how we get from crash victim to ultimately us all paying is an important question, but it's one that might concern the companies more than individual consumers.
You mean the car companies?
Yes.
That them
companies
being,
that are developing these technologies.
And it sort of reminds me of a question I was talking about the other day, is if we get autonomous, if we have robots, flying robots delivering packages, and it drops on your head, the package, instead of on your lawn, isn't that sort of the same kind of question we're asking?
It is. It is. And I will tell you, if you have to be hit by a car, and no one wants to be, you are better off getting hit by an automated vehicle. And the reason why is because the companies and developers and users of those vehicles are at least initially likely to have deeper pockets than your ordinary negligent driver.
And the ones that are driving out, the test cars that are out there now, who's liable for those?
So if one of those were to be at fault in a crash, the people injured in the crash could turn to the individual drivers, but would much more likely turn to the developer of the systems and the company actually conducting the testing, whether it's an automaker or Google or a university, and say, hey, you put out a system on the road that injured me through its failure. Pay up.
Well, let's talk about the car itself and the ethics of some of the things the car might decide to do. Let me give you a hypothetical question. Let's say in a case where an accident seems imminent and people have to make quick choices where to swerve. A dog runs out into the middle of the street, let's say, and you either have a choice, if you're driving, of hitting the dog or hitting another car next to you, or maybe some other, or hitting a tree. Who decides what the car chooses there? How does the car make that decision?
Well, the first question is, was the vehicle going too fast in the first place? Had it been going at a slower speed, could it avoid that so-called dilemma situation altogether? Drawing the boundaries of our analysis larger is one of the things that automated vehicles may well do, so that we get into these situations less frequently. But let's assume hypothetically that an automated vehicle were to encounter this choice of bad situations. Well, depending on the particular programming and the particular level of automation we're talking about, it may simply try to take as much energy out of the system as possible. Brake really fast. That may avoid the dog. It would certainly avoid the other car. It may not avoid the dog, but it might be justifiable legally and ethically. If it's a more sophisticated car, then it's going to have more decisions to make, but those will always be checked by uncertainty. We won't really know, and the car won't really know the results of all its decisions until it's
taken
them.
Well, what if I am given the option for that car to choose? Like you put options into your computer. What if I say, if it comes down between hitting a dog and hitting the car, and I want to put this crassly, I'd rather hit the dog because I could kill somebody hitting the car. Can I make that as an option in my software that runs the computer, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Well, now you can't. In some systems that exist in production today, you can adjust perhaps the aggressiveness of a system, so you're following a vehicle closer than you might otherwise. You're following faster than you might otherwise. Those are options. As the systems get more sophisticated, might it be possible that more user preferences could be integrated? Mm-hmm. Yes, but subject to some limits. I don't think you'll ever get to say, I want to just hit every dog I can find.
Let me bring in my other guests, David King, Susan Handy. What do you think about these choices?
Well, I think on this last point, this is a really big issue as to who owns the code for these cars, who owns the programming. And there's recently some court cases where the owner of the car, rather than the manufacturer, actually has the rights to make changes of the code on existing cars. And if that holds for autonomous cars, you may end up that they start driving in certain ways that reflect the personalities of the individuals, and that would be a very, very different type of a much more competitive market on the streets, which would be problematic.
Susan, any comments on this?
Yeah, I think this is outside my area of expertise.
Yeah, but then you'll have the problem of hackers, right? People can hack into the code. They want to do something crazy to upset it, and then who's responsible for that sort of thing? Right? Any thinking about that going on?
A intrusion into a system is another kind of failure. And if it's one that the developer should have anticipated, could have prevented, then it's a pretty clear case of liability. Mm-hmm. In some cases, even if no physical damage occurs, companies could be liable for the diminished value of their products or for representing the safety or security of their systems as better than it actually was.
Let me go to the phones. Before a few minutes we have left, let's go to Bruce in Mountain View, California. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Ira. Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be on your show. I actually cannot believe it. Listen, I am a driver for Uber. I've been doing it for about a year and a quarter now, and I have a lot of doubts about driverless cars just by knowing the people I pick up. People are babies. They change your destinations all the time. They want you to stop here and there. There's so many factors involved with this technology. I don't think it's going to be ready. It may be ready, and there's a lot of hype like you're talking about. There's a big hype gap there, but I don't think people as a public are going to be ready for this for a while. Now, I may be wrong, because I pick up a lot of Stanford students, and none of them have cars anymore. And as you were saying, you know, back in our generation, that's all we wanted when we were teenagers. We wanted to get behind the wheel. We wanted cars. We couldn't get our license quick enough. Today, I don't get that feeling. Kids don't want to drive cars, and they're back there and they're content on having the flexibility to go out and drink and do things. But my gut feeling is there's just so many problems with this car or with these cars coming out in terms of the responsibility. Yeah. For instance, who gets hit, the amount of pedestrians. I mean, driving in San Francisco with the number of pedestrians, I just cannot see.
All right. I get it. I'm here in New York. I understand what you're saying. Thanks for calling. I mean, it's going to take a little longer.
I mean, there's a lot of cars on the road. There's a lot of infrastructure in the built environment, and our cities are built around driving right now, for good or bad. And it's going to take a long time to change that.
Susan, you think it's going to take a generational change?
Well, I think there's some generational change happening. But I think, as the caller points out, you know, we've got a lot of important innovation going on right now. Autonomous vehicles, you know, they're somewhere down the road, almost surely. But in the meantime, we've got a lot of other things happening that are very important, that are expanding the transportation options that are available, whether it's car sharing or ride sharing services like Uber and Lyft. We're seeing innovation in in bicycling with bike sharing systems and electric assist bicycles. We're seeing new forms of transit service, some of which are privately provided. And I think all of this, you know, it's expanding the options, and it is contributing to changes in how we think about transportation that will especially be affecting the younger generations. So I think, you know, not even talking about autonomous vehicles, that we've got a lot of change going on that's going to mean a very different transportation future.
Final thought, David?
Well, just to add to that, there's also online shopping. There's also delivery. There's far more options to driving now than there ever have been. And it's not at all clear as to when we reduce driving, does that mean that people are going to continue to do the same amount of travel but in an autonomous car, or are they simply going to travel less and make fewer trips?
Brian, any last prediction at all about where we're headed?
Oh, all the things that we think are going to be here tomorrow are going to take forever, and it's the things we don't even see coming that are going to surprise us.
Okay. So certainly.
Exactly.
Certainly the philosophy of a New York Fifth Avenue pedestrian. David King is Assistant Professor of Urban Planning at Columbia University. Susan Handy, Director of the National Center for Sustainable Transportation at the University of California at Davis. Bryant Walker-Smith, Assistant Professor, School of Law, UC, University of South Carolina. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And happy driving to you all. Imagine you're walking down a street in Peekskill, New York, and a shop window catches your eye. Behind the glass are elaborate mechanisms made out of metal and rubber and leather. Are they torture devices? Are they movie props? Just what do these carefully crafted instruments do? Our video producer, Luke Raskin, stepped inside that curiosity shop to find out, and he brings us the story in our new Sci-Fi video. Welcome, Luke. Did you just stumble on this place?
Well, kind of, sort of. So I was walking along on along the Hudson River in Peekskill. And there's an old industrial building, very unassuming. And it, on the outside, it says Early Electrics. And I walk in, and it looks like I've walked into a steampunk cabinet of curiosities. Ooh. It's musky. It's got old mahogany cabinets filled with all sorts of incredible scientific equipment and medical devices, instruments of quackery and anatomical models, all sorts of prosthetics and gas masks from all sorts of ages throughout time.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Luke Raskin about his find in the place called Early Electric. So you go inside and you're scooping around.
Yeah, and you walk upstairs, and there's just rack upon rack of old gas lamps that have been refurbished. And then there's this horse. It's a full-size horse.
A real horse?
No. It's a papier-mâché horse.
A papier-mâché horse.
It's absolutely gorgeous. Just to be clear, it's really macabre as well. It looks like a skinned horse. So all the skin's been taken off, and you can see the muscles and the veins, and it's extremely detailed. And it was made by this fellow in the 1800s named Dr. Azu, who got tired of using cadavers to demonstrate to veterinary students how to dissect a horse or care for a horse. And so he started making it out of papier-mâché, and it's this, like, puzzle that comes together. It's many different pieces, and it's a constructed horse, absolutely gorgeous.
And as you say, these are not just quacky devices, but they're beautifully designed pieces, right?
Aesthetically, they have so much character. Some of these masks look like they're right out of Metropolis, the movie. You can see the art movement at which they were created, the art movements during which they were created, in the actual pieces. So you can see, you know, expressionism in these dentistry practice anatomical models, these phantoms, as they're called. You can see Victorian clawed tables. You can see more modern, you know, tin and aluminum, very sleek, very, very simplistic designs. So you get more of that of it than just a whirlwind tour of past medical devices.
Are some of these medical devices clearly quackery, what is that thing?
Yeah.
Plugs into your ears, whatever, that sort of.
Yeah, there's some of them are like that. There was one instrument that was used in the Victorian era where you hold two metal rods and they crank electricity into your hands and you kind of catches you. You're like, really? Did they think that worked? And apparently they did. And there was the this infamous chair from the Kellogg Sanitarium that would shake you. It's like a vibrating chair that was supposed to loosen your bowels. I did not try it.
I was going to ask you.
I did not try it.
As a good reporter, you sit down in that
chair. No, I'm not that type of reporter. And I would definitely not try it.
Well, it might go up in smoke if you plugged it in anyhow.
Yeah, it's a little old. Some of these things are clearly quack devices. And then, you know, some of them you have to ask yourself, like, did they really know that this was quack? Did they think that this was the best at the time? And so that made me wonder. And I asked the owner of the shop, the collector, this man named Steve Ehrenberg, who's been collecting for 30 years. What you know, he has a lot of knowledge about these devices. What does he think? What does he think about our current day devices based on this?
I can't help but think when I see some of these new devices that are being used and new materials that 100 years from now we'll be looking back at them and laughing and calling them quack devices. But that's what science is. We always think state of the art and that we're ahead of our time and it'll never get any more modern than that, but it's always changing.
You know, a few years from now, what? They use these little hand devices?
Right. Or they're cutting into people for surgery? That sounds crazy. The telephone. You know, we're now on cell phones. You look at a rotary phone and you go, that's ridiculous.
So this is our video. It's up on our video.
It is. It's called Things of Beauty, Scientific Instruments of Yore.
And you can all watch it at sciencefriday.com. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Ira.
And what does a theoretical physicist think about fortune cookies? That's what also we're talking about this week. And you can find out in our interview with Alan Guth, one of the Nobel Prize winners who pioneered the inflationary model of the universe. You can read that story at sciencefriday.com/inflation. He's really an interesting person to get to know. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Production assistant is Becky Fogel, who has left us and has gone on to better places in Texas. We wish her great success. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And if you like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And if you like us on our Facebook page. And we're tweeting all week at SciFry. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.